Thank you for that reading. I think I gave Paul a bit of a fright because he's actually going to speak to us on Genesis 39 and 40.
Quick bit of recap there and looking at a few other passages that he hadn't planned to look at now. Let's put that down a bit. I'm not as tall as Sunday's speaker, whoever they were. I want to start off by just reading you some words, and I'm sure most of you will know exactly where these come from. It says he, having looked up the wrong passage now. Not a good start, sorry about this. Okay. Knowing this first, that no prophecy of Scripture is of any private interpretation. For the prophecy came not in old time by the will of man, but holy men of God spake as they were moved by the Holy Spirit. And we often quote that to support the idea that all of this that we have before us tonight is God's word. I'm quoting that tonight to show you that an example of the outworking of that has actually got Joseph into the position where he is in these chapters that we're going to consider tonight, chapters 39 and 40. That is, as a slave in Egypt. Come with me, will you please, to Genesis chapter 37 then, for starters, where we get the incident of Joseph already somewhat unpopular with his brothers, with his siblings, simply because he was the favourite with the parent. And as much as we know that that's how it is, it quite clearly shows how the scripture sort of, it's so real, isn't it? Because, you know, if you have favourites in families, it's always going to cause a problem. And we know that this is the case. Verse 4, and when his brethren, Joseph's brethren, saw that their father loved him more than all his brethren, they hated him and could not speak peaceably unto him. Oh, well, we know that. That's not a nice starting point as far as Joseph's concerned. You know, they couldn't say a nice word about him. They couldn't say a nice word to his face. They couldn't say a nice word to each other about him. In point of fact, they absolutely despised him. Then Joseph, rather than trying to sort out this problem and win back the favour of his siblings, does what? Verse 5, and Joseph dreamed a dream and told it unto his brethren, and they hated him yet the more. Now, we know the interpretation of the dream. We're not looking at it tonight. But I put it to you that I don't think Joseph had got any real choice in telling his brethren that dream from that passage we've just looked at in 2 Peter. He just spoke it out. It certainly wasn't going to help him in the short term. His brothers already hated him. And if you follow on, they hated him even the more because of this. Verse 6, and he said unto them, hear, I pray you, that I have dreamed a dream I have dreamed, and behold, we have blinded it, and so on. And at the end of verse 8, I think we're down to, and his brethren said to him, shalt thou indeed reign over us, or shalt thou indeed have dominion over us? And they hated him yet the more because of it. And as if he'd done it once and hadn't learned from that mistake, and it isn't a mistake, because I don't think he had a choice in it. God, you know, breathed these words out. Joseph said them. Joseph was given the dreams, and Joseph said them. It was what was meant to be happening. You get the same thing repeating itself in verse 9. And he dreamed yet another dream, and he told it unto his brethren, and he said, behold, I have, and you'll see again, they hated him even more for that. So I think what we've got here, and we know that this is true in the sense that when Joseph sees his brothers much later on, when he's one of the key men in Egypt, and they come to him and they're worried that he's going to kill them, and he says that God sent me here. Well, this is part and parcel of God sending him there, because his actions that he took at that point in time, those breathed out words that he said and spoke, quite clearly were going to not help him stay where he was in the family situation. It was what God wanted to happen. It was God's will and purpose. And I wonder if, and I only say I wonder, if this is an outworking of that idea that we just looked at in 2 Peter chapter 1. So with that being said, let's go to the two chapters I want to consider tonight, where Joseph has been sold and he's now in Egypt. The situation is that he's been brought down there as a slave. Verse 1 of chapter 39, and Joseph was brought down into Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him at the hands of the Ishmaelites, which had brought him down. So this gentleman called Potiphar buys him as a slave. And that literally is the money changed hands to buy a person. And that sounds really weird to us, doesn't it? You know, I like that one, I'm buying it. You know, he looks like he could be a good slave, I'll buy that one. That seemed very abhorrent to us. We don't understand the culture. That was really, had been the culture for many, many centuries, probably millennia in one form or another in different places. It certainly was in Egypt then, and it certainly was at the time of Paul the Apostle, many, many years later. That was the culture. People owned each other. That's quite a frightening thought in a way, isn't it, to us, in the comfortable position we find ourselves in. But it was an ownership. It's quite strange that they seem to make a big deal of who Potiphar was. First of all, we see that Joseph was brought down into Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh's captain, so he's high up the rank of the guard, an Egyptian. Well, why mention he's an Egyptian? If he's high ranking, somewhere up in office, you know, responsibility for the guard of Pharaoh, Pharaoh's guard, is what it says there, Pharaoh, captain of the guard, Why do we have it mentioned that he's actually an Egyptian? And as if it isn't enough that it's just mentioned once, it actually comes out in verse 2 as well. And the Lord was with Joseph, and he was a prosperous man. We'll come to the detail of that in a minute. And it was in the house of the master in his master's, the Egyptian. It's mentioned he's an Egyptian again there. And if we go down to verse 5, and it came to pass from the time that he had made him overseer in his house, and over all that he had, that the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house. Why such a big issue of mentioning over and over again, three times in those within the first five verses of this dialogue? It mentions, and remember, God's inspired this. It isn't me just picking these verses out. God's written it down three times, finds it important to tell the world that he was an Egyptian. And yet it seemed a very likely thing that he should have been an Egyptian. He was high ranking in Egypt. And it seems like, you know, why on earth has God wasted his words? Oh, no, God wouldn't have wasted his words. I think it is this, that Potiphar's name is, when translated, he whom Ra gives, he whom Ra gives. And Ra was a god of Lower Egypt. And what's happened very recently, just before this event, we have a complete change of dynasty. But they've kept this man on, Potiphar. And that's what this is telling us, that they've kept Potiphar on after the dynasty change. He was still an Egyptian from this area. And so in one sense, I think, you know, it's quite interesting that history, as it's unwound, has shown us why it was important at this point in time to mention that he was an Egyptian. As history, you know, we found out about this in the relatively near past, that this was the case. We now know that the Lower Egypt under new dynasty and Potiphar had been kept on. And again, this example of the Bible being incredibly accurate way before its time. The critics have hammered this in the past as well. What you keep saying about he's an Egyptian. Of course he's an Egyptian. Well, no, it wasn't that obvious of that particular dynasty. And I think if you went into the wording of it more, you would find that it was actually more to do with where in Egypt he came from. But that's as it may be. Let's move on and consider the contents of these two verses. We see that Joseph doesn't miss a chance to preach. Let's pick it up in verse 2 for starters. And the Lord was with Joseph, and he was a prosperous man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. So he was a prosperous man. He was a slave. He was owned by another man to do work. So how can you relate him to being prosperous? You know, again, people have criticised the scriptures over this. And his master saw that the Lord was with him. And notice that it's capital L-O-R-D. How did Potiphar know about Yahweh? Well, there's only one way, as far as I can think out, was with him, and that the Lord made all that he did to prosper his hand. Did Joseph just take this opportunity to preach? Tell Potiphar about his God, who he was from, where he'd come from, what it was all about. He'd known he'd come from, and he preached God to him. And then as backup to this, and I stress I think it's backup, God makes him to prosper. And then Potiphar's going, you know, that lad's got some point. He said God was with him, and who God was, and he worshipped him and wasn't going to worship the Egyptian gods, etc. And I'm putting that bit in, it's not there, not recorded for us. And now we have this beautiful thing where he's been prospered in is his own house, Pharaoh's own house is being prospered, and he's sort of making regulation, a thought there, Joseph's been preaching to him. I can't see any other way. When we read that verse 3, and his master saw that the Lord was with him. Somebody was blessing Joseph above and beyond the natural slave. He got a winner here. The money he paid for this slave was an absolute winner, wasn't it? And this carries on as we read down, because it says, and Joseph found grace in the sight, and he served him, and he made him to prosper over the house, and all that he had, he put into his hand. So Joseph's, I think, preaching to Pharaoh, telling Pharaoh about what he believed in, what was his motivator, what was his driving, what kept him positive, you know, above all these other things, was God. And Potiphar seems to have responded to that in a very positive way, and just said, I can see God's working with you. Yahweh's working with you. Therefore, you know, I tell you what, you have this job, you take a control in my house. And it goes on, doesn't it, in verse 5, and it came to pass from that time that he made him overseer in his house and over all that he had, that the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake, and the blessing of the Lord was upon all that he had in the house and in the field. So here we have, for Joseph's sake, this blessing being put onto the household of Potiphar. And that is both in his house, whatever that means, that phrase. I struggled a little bit to find out what they meant. But end of the field is very sensible, very obvious. Wherever he planted crops, they grew well. So all he grew prospered, and the preparation and the feeding of their family. So everything that Joseph put his hands to seems to, you know, the phrase we'd use is turned to gold, but I think you know what I mean by that phrase. That things were going well here, and Potiphar was greatly benefiting from Joseph's blessing by God. And he trusts him completely. Now, I don't know the year, how long this went on for. I don't believe it was a particularly long time. But there's no doubt about it that during this period of time, Potiphar was benefiting because Joseph was a God-fearing man. And he was benefiting just because they were rubbing shoulders and he was working there. He could do the job of loads of other people. He looked after the house. He hadn't got to worry about a thing. It was all sorted. And in addition to all that, the house prospered. They had more money. They had more wealth than what they'd had previously. So having Joseph there, this was the best slave he'd ever bought. The best slave he'd ever bought. Verse 7. And it came to pass after these things that his master's wife cast her eyes upon Joseph, and she said, lie with me. Now, here we have a pretty amazing thing. And it came to pass after this that the master's wife cast her eyes upon Joseph. He'd been around for quite some time by this time. Was it now because the family had prospered and she'd got some time of leisure? I don't know. That she'd now got time on her hands because they could buy more slaves and more people were doing the work around the house, etc. I think she'd probably had quite a few to start with. But clearly, she decides she wants to give a closer relationship with this man, with Joseph. And she's quite blatant and outspoken about why it was. Now, we need to just pause a little while there, because I do think, excuse me, that it's unreasonable to give in to these temptations, but Joseph must have got something special about him. First of all, he was confident. He was confident because God, he was doing God's will and doing God's work. And that bubbled over in him, and hence the reason he could be in charge of the whole house. He was a natural leader, if you like, or he'd become a natural leader in being given the talents of it. But at the back end of verse 6, we see something else about him. And Joseph was a goodly person and well-favoured. And I think we struggle to think of that as being anything, but he was a good-looking lad. The same words are used to describe his mother, Genesis chapter 29. Not that she was a good-looking lad, obviously. But the same word was used to describe his mother. Back in Genesis chapter 29, and verse 17, we read, Leah was tender-eyed, but Rachel was beautiful and well-favoured. And there we have that word again. So it seems to be a family trait. Physically, he looked good. Whatever good was in those days, whatever was attractive, quite clearly he was that. And he was prospering. So that must have made him quite an attraction to Potiphar's wife. Notice the refusal. Okay, Joseph doesn't give in to this temptation, and if we think about it, that must have been a strong temptation. From a male point of view, here he is, a young, healthy, fit man who's obviously prospering, but living in a foreign country, and there's this woman throwing herself at him, almost literally. But what does he do? There's two bits to his refusal. But he refused, verse 8, now back in 39, but he refused and said unto his master's wife, Behold, my master wanteth not what is with me in the house, and he hath committed all that he hath into my hand. There is none greater, and this isn't a boast, there is none greater in this house than I. Neither hath he kept anything from me but thee, because thou art his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? Now, it isn't the Lord there, capital L-O-R-D, and I think there's probably a reason for that. Because he would feel he was sinning against God. Well, he would be sinning against God, and as we know, that was quite clearly the wrong thing to do. He explains to her that your husband is a wonderful man. He trusts me, and there's no way I want that trust to be misplaced. He's saying to her, isn't he? You know, there's no way it's going to be misplaced. But notice what he said, and sin against God. Who is he referring to in that verse? Because it isn't L-O-R-D, capitals. I put it to you as a suggestion, and again, this is only a suggestion. I think he deliberately chose not to go L-O-R-D, because I don't think she believed like her husband did. Because I think her husband fairly much believed that Joseph's God was more powerful than any other gods. She didn't, I don't think. So when he uses the word God there, sin against God, from his own point of view, he's referring to the God, the great creator and sustainer. I know I would be sinning against the great creator and sustainer if I was to lie with you. But to her, I think he's drawing her eye to her husband, who's very much in charge and the powerful one. And I think that's probably, and I'd be very interested if other people have got other thoughts on it, but why has he gone from, previously it was referred to as, you know, the capitals, L-O-R-D, and now when he's talking to her, I think that was above and beyond where she was at in that period in time in her life, and therefore there's this possibility it's both ways. I know it would be against a great creator and sustainer, but as far as you're concerned, if I can draw your attention to how that would be against the superior person in your life, if you like, for us to do this, and trying to get her to think, you know, there's a problem here. Please don't go down that avenue. I'm not going to let you go down that avenue. You know, is the way he's speaking here. Moving on to verse 16, and it came to pass as she spake to Joseph day by day that he hearkened not unto her to lie with her or to be with her, and that's an important one. There's lessons there for us to be learned. I'm not going to suggest that any of us blokes are going to have a woman come to him and say, come and sleep with me. But nonetheless, the lesson there is to remove the temptation. Notice what he's done there. He said, no. She's kept asking. And what has he done? He's removed the temptation. He's put distance between them. And it came to pass, I read the verse again, and spake to Joseph day by day that he hearkened not unto her to lie with her or to be with her. He made certain they weren't alone together. That's the feeling I get from that. He wasn't going to be with her. There must have been some opportunities because she kept asking him. There must have been a bit of private conversation, unless she got bold enough to ask in front of the other servants, the other people around. I doubt it by what happens later on. But he removes himself from the temptation not to be with her. And okay, I think there's lots of lessons for us to learn there. There are temptations that get thrown at us. No, they don't, do they? They come from within. We know that from the scripture. But to remove ourselves from the temptation, the trigger that starts that temptation off, trying to make a line, draw a line, make a gap between, remove it, put it further out from ourselves, whatever that trigger is. Then we get the sad part of it, all this. And it came to pass about at the time that Joseph went into the house to do his business, and there was none of the men of the house there within. Does that suggest that normally there would have been? He said he's put a distance between them by saying he doesn't be with her. Maybe that today he made a mistake. He didn't check, were the other workers in the house? Were the other blokes here? I don't know. It's just a speculation. But clearly it seems to be unusual that there was nobody else in the house. And she caught him by his garment, saying, Lie with me. And he left his garment in her hand and fled away and got out. And this is where that conniving mind I've been rejected. I couldn't have made it clear. I made it an instruction almost. He's told, you know, I'm the lady of the house, and I made an instruction to this servant, this Hebrew servant even, and he's refusing to. And the mind then clocks over and gets really, really wicked. She could be in a situation now where Joseph tells Potiphar what's happened, gets the story in. What's going to happen to Joseph? Who knows? What's going to happen to her? Who knows? She makes certainly doesn't work that way. How quick her mind is to put this story together, and it's worrying that the human mind is like this. And may I put it to you that none of us are exempt from this kind of thing. When our backs are against the wall, I know I've thought things and planned things that, whoa, there's no way they should have been there. And it came to pass, when she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and was fled forth, wow, I got a bit of evidence. And she called unto the men of the house straight away. So they must have been within earshot. They weren't in the house previously, but they must have been within earshot. And she gets in there, and she spake unto them, saying, see, he hath brought in an Hebrew, leaning on their prejudices, using other people's weaknesses for her benefit. Because there must have been prejudice. Why mention it otherwise? Unto this house to mock us. He hired a Hebrew servant, and we're all here, good, solid Egyptians. They have come to mock us, and this Hebrew that he's got to mock us, he came in unto me to lie with me, and I cried out with a loud voice, which he had done. They'd heard that. This is all part of her plan. And it came to pass when he heard that I lifted up my voice. So when he heard that I lifted up my voice and cried, that he left his garment with me and fled and got him out. And she laid up the garment by her until her Lord came back. So she did talk about him as her Lord, a master in the house, and that's why I suggest that maybe that previous verse in back in verse 9 was that idea. She kept the evidence. She'd got a story planned, and I can imagine while she's waiting for him to come back on the number 9 bus and catch the train or whatever it was to get home, that these thoughts are building in her mind. How can I put this? What's going to be the most convincing way? And you know, and then when Potiphar arrives home, she tells him, doesn't she? Verse 17, and she spake unto him according to these words, saying, the Hebrew servant, very important that he's a Hebrew. I've told you about this Hebrew servant before, type of thing almost. The Hebrew servant which thou hast brought unto us came in unto me to mock me. And he came in to, as it was, I lifted up my voice and cried with a loud, and he left his garment. His suggestion is he'd taken his garments off to defile me, but when I shouted, he ran and he legged it. You know, the same. The facts are the same. It's the spin on them, isn't it? You know, the actual actions, not the facts, the actual actions are the same. It's the spin on them that's the problem. And what a lie. And how convincing a lie. And the worrying part about it is that your and my minds are no different to hers if we let them run. We aren't any different. We're all sinful creatures. We're all capable of doing things like this. And she just let her mind run. And she makes this very convincing story. So when we come to verse 19, we come to, and it came to pass, when his master heard the words of his wife, which he spake unto him, saying, after this manner did thy servant to me, that his wrath was kindled. We assume that he was angry with Joseph. Reading that verse, it seems to be, he's listened to his wife. His wife told him this, let me get my hands on that Joseph bloke. And when he does get his hands on his Joseph bloke, what does he do? Sticks him in prison. There's no mention of a public flogging or anything like that, a beating. There's no mention of getting the other servants to hold him up and kick him to bits, you know, which must have been the instinct if that was the case. And what prison does he put him into? He puts him in the prison where the king puts prisoners in. Not just any willy-nilly prison, I don't think. It seems to be where the best people go. Yes, they've got to offend to get there, but it seems to be a hierarchy prison to me. It isn't the general dregs. Again, that's speculation on my behalf. Weigh it up, kick it out if it doesn't fit with your logic. You know, and please, but before you kick it out, let me know you're kicking it out, because I'd like to know as well. And then we go down, we get the same thing happening all over again, don't we? Verse 21. But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy and gave him favour in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners that were in the prison. And whatsoever they did, he was the doer of it. I've heard it argued, I don't go with this one, that in actual fact, that was one of Potiphar's roles. was to run the prisons, or he was over the prisons as well. Now, I don't know that, and I don't particularly go with that, but it seems to be, it's a very similar process that we've had when first went into Potiphar's house as a common slave, grew up to become the man in charge of the house, the second under his master, his main servant. Now he's gone into prison, and the same thing's happened. He's become the man who does all the work in the prison, basically. Okay? I do think it's important, though, not to lose sight of another scriptural piece of evidence that are given to us about what it was like for Joseph in prison. It's very easy to sort of take this and say, well, look, he's just prospering in prison. He's the guy with the keys, you know, he goes around. The keeper of the prison looked not to anything, I'm reading verse 23, that was under his hand, because the Lord was with him, and that did he do, the Lord made him to prosper. So he'd just been given the keys to the place, at least the inner cells. You know, and he seemed to be able to just look after everybody and do the thing. And so the thought is, had he already, Joseph, spoken to the chief, the prison guard here? Had he preached to him? Certainly the prison guard saw that he prospered if he let Joseph get on with it. And the thought there is that Joseph was a very impressive man, and he showed his love of God out front all the time. And I think people saw that, and it obviously had a great effect on some of the people. But I don't think we should miss this opportunity to look at a scripture in Psalm 105, where we get just a very little snippet. The psalmist is telling us about the conditions that Joseph went under. Psalm 105 and verse 17. He sent a man before them, even Joseph, who was sold for a servant. So we know we're talking about, and we know the story. We can see exactly, we know we're talking about the same thing. Whose feet they hurt with fetters, he was laid in iron. Until the time of the word came. So there is an idea that he was in charge in the prisons, but there it says, doesn't it? He sent a man over them, even Joseph, who was sold for a servant, verse 18, whose feet they hurt with fetters. So Joseph, at least for a period of time, was restrained in that prison. You know, so we know from what we just looked at in Genesis that he rose to a position of some great command. He couldn't just wander out the place, though. I don't think that for one moment, okay? But he was restrained there. But at one point, it was fetters on his feet and they hurt him. And I don't think we should lose sight of that. I have a brother at live meeting to thank for that, because I didn't even know that, and that's why it's in a different colour print here on mine. And I think that's a great point, though, all joking aside, that we shouldn't miss things out like that. The Bible comments on these things, and we need to put them all together as best as we can. Right, coming through into the 40th chapter, we'll have a quick look at some of this. And it came to pass after these things that the butler of the kings of Egypt and his baker had offended the Lord, and they're going to the king of Egypt. So Pharaoh, very fussy man, both these two guys had upset him, and they were thrown into prison. Okay, and Pharaoh was wroth against the two of his office, against the chief of the butlers and against the chief of the bakers. But this is the verse I want to go to. And he put them inward in the house of the captain of the guard, unto the prison, the place where Joseph was bound. Bound. Word doesn't mean tied up necessarily, incidentally. It can just mean restrained. And the captain of the guard charged Joseph with them, and he served them, and they continued a season inward. Their prison sentence had got a fixed time to it. There was going to be some end to this period of time. There was going to be a judgment. It may be, we know what happened, but there was a period of time they were in for. Doesn't appear that was the case with Joseph. He was on a life sentence, I think. It appears quite different there with Joseph. But he's put in there, and although we still talk about Joseph being bound, he was clearly over them and looking after them. What an interesting thought. He'd already risen, whilst in prison, to a point of being in charge of some of the high-ranking people in Egypt. The servants that had got to the point of actually going to Pharaoh and offering him food and making him food and drink. And Joseph was in charge of them. You know, this is a sign of things to come, isn't it, as time rolls on. So there they are in prison, and the captain of the guard, verse 5, and both of them, and they dream, both of them, each man, his dream in one night, each man according to the interpretation of his dream. the butler and the baker, and the king of Egypt, which were bound in the prison. And Joseph came into them in the morning and looked upon them, and behold, they were sad. Now, what's interesting here, we've just talked about Joseph being bound in prison, but he must, and I think what it means there is that he couldn't go beyond the prison, but clearly he was opening up the prisons for other people at this point in time. And Joseph came unto them in the morning. So Joseph's moving around and waking people up, if you like, you know, and so he's got a limit of freedom, but he's still referred to as being bound. We've just looked at that, which suggests that he couldn't go beyond the buildings or beyond certain boundaries of this building that they were in. And he sees these two that in the morning, and they are depressed, to say the least, that they're very worried. Verse 7, and he said, and he asked Pharaoh's officers that were with him in the ward of his lord's house, saying, why look ye so sadly today? And they're strong words. They were depressed, and they explained immediately to him. And they said unto him, we have dreamed a dream, and there is no interpreter of the dream. And that was what was bothering them. They both dreamed a dream. Joseph's there in the morning speaking to them, and they said, we've dreamed a dream, and no one to interpret it. Now, you and I have dreams on a regular basis, and we don't need to have them interpreted, and we don't necessarily believe that they meant anything anyway. They're just, you know, well, I can see where that's come from and that kind of thing. That was not the culture here. The culture seems to be that if you have this type of dream, maybe this was a very forceful dream as well, but they really did expect this dream to mean something. Now, it's okay, there's something special about this, and it wasn't just their culture, I don't think, something special about it. There's nobody here. I'll tell you what, if we were outside, I could have gone to so-and-so, but I'm stuck in here. Nobody's going to tell me what this dream means. Look at Joseph, immediately responded. Do not interpretations belong to God? Tell me them, I pray. Now, Joseph isn't here saying, just tell me your prayers, your dreams rather, and I'll tell you what they mean. He's already stated they belong to God. Now, I know it's, you know, just G-O-D. I know it's got a capital G, but again, these people probably wouldn't have understood Lord and understood where he was coming from with that. But there is no self-glorification in Joseph here whatsoever. He knew that God, well, he probably knew that God was going to tell him what these dreams meant, but there was no glory for me. This has come from God, not from me. We know the chief butler has his say first, and he tells Joseph the dream. And in this dream, we have it in verse 10, and the vine was the three branches, and it budded, and his blossoms went sent forth, and the clusters were brought forth ripe grapes. And Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, and I took the grapes and pressed them into Pharaoh's cup, and I gave the cup into Pharaoh's hand. Now, critics of the Bible have just read this and gone, yes, 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 what a load of rubbish. There's no vines in Egypt. That's what everybody believed up until relatively recently, until they've unearthed certain things in Egypt and found the stones, etc., which have vines on them. And so it's just another example of the Bible being correct. Man saying, you haven't got the evidence to back that up whatsoever. Look, there's no vines in Egypt. Oh, hang on. After a bit more digging, we found this with a definite picture of a vine and people making drinks out of grapes. Again, and I think this is going to be the case if we're patient enough, or if the Lord allows us enough time, with lots of things where people say there's a contradiction with Scripture to what's happening in everyday life. As life rolls on, as the time rolls on, more and more of the Scripture is being shown to be accurate and true. And I think there will be a day, it may be when Jesus returns to this earth, that the theory of evolution, and I stress the word theory, will be thrown out the window to be shown, all the evidence actually doesn't support that, does it? It may come, it may not come, you know, we have to wait and see. But that certainly is an example here where man's jumped on the bandwagon, vines in Egypt, oh, what a load of rubbish, throw the Bible out, get rid of it. Oh, we better get it back because we've just found some bits and pieces that show vines in Egypt. Interpretation of it, Joseph's not slow in telling him. And Joseph, verse 12, and Joseph said unto him, this is the interpretation of the three branches of 3 days. And within 3 days shall Pharaoh lift up your head and restore thee to the place which thou art delivered. Pharaoh's cup into his hand after the former manner when you were his butler. But Joseph puts a plea in. But just remember me, please, when this happens. just remember me, just remember about this bread. But think on me when you shall be well with thee, and show kindness, I pray thee, unto me, and make mention of me unto Pharaoh, and bring me out of this house. So he was stuck there, obviously. Although he got this freedom within the place and responsibilities within the prison, he was still stuck there. And then we know the next dream, obviously spurred on by the nice results of this first dream. Yeah, 3 days. I had three in my dream as well. So they've got to be similar. And he's going back to work, according to what Joseph's saying, although there must have been some tentative thoughts about this here. And of course, when we have this dream told, the answer is quite different. Verse 18, and Joseph answered and said, this is the interpretation there. The three baskets are 3 days. And you thought three meant the same thing? 3 days, 3 days. And incidentally, I think if we look through the chronology of this, Pharaoh had got a birthday coming up in 3 days. That can't be tied down exactly. But there clearly was a special event that was due. Hence the reason they'd only been put in for a season. And hence the dreams had come with anxieties, because they were starting to get to the point where, hang on, that period of time is coming towards an end. Something's going to happen to us. It could be good, it could be bad. Well, it was good, and it was bad, depending on whether you were a butler or a baker. Yet within 3 days shall Pharaoh lift up thy head from off thee this time. Not lift up your head from the prison, but from off you. He's going to go. And shall hang thee on a tree, and the bird shall eat thy flesh, and from off thee. So Joseph tells these two interpretations. Clearly, they are totally different results. Now, he got no need to tell the guy that he was going to die. He got no need to tell the guy that he was going to live, but he might have been tempted to tell the other one he was going to live as well, so that he got three days a bit more pleasant for him. It didn't happen, did it? And the third day, verse 20, and it came to pass the third day, which was Pharaoh's birthday. Now, whether they knew this previously, we do know it's his birthday, whether we can chronologically put that to how long the period of time was that they'd been in prison was, he will make a decision on his birthday. I sort of think they probably did. Knowing how Pharaoh did things and how the culture ran, they'd been right next to him for goodness knows how long, so that they would have known the culture and the routines. They knew his birthday would have been good. Maybe he lost a little bit of track of what the days were, etc., being in prison, but nonetheless, they knew that they felt that there would be a decision made on his birthday. That he made a feast unto all his servants, and he lifted up the head of the chief butler and of the chief baker among his servants, and he restored the chief butler unto the butlership again, and he gave the cup to Pharaoh's hand, just as it had been said, and he hanged the chief baker as Joseph had interpreted to them. Yet did not the chief butler remember Joseph, but forgot him. Now, it's interesting, and I do appreciate it's part of the way things are said sometimes, but there's two parts to verse 23, isn't there? Yet did not the chief butler remember Joseph, but forgat him. And if you look up the word for forgat, I'm not going to try and pronounce it, I'll just give you the number, 7911, it's an active word, to be forgotten, to make forgotten, the suggestion of it. I think it's an active thing. I've got my job back. I can remember what Joseph said to me, but if I start asking him that, I might upset him again, and I could be in a lot. I'll get that out of my head. An active thought of separating him, putting out of his head. Just like Joseph removed himself from the temptation that was being thrown at him. He put a gap between them. And it's an active thing, and this forget is an active thing. He did, the chief butler didn't remember, chief butler remembered, sorry, but the chief, I'll try reading it again, yet did not the chief butler remember. The reason he didn't remember, because he made an effort to forget. Let's fill my life with something else and get up and get away from this, and to make certain that I don't get into that again. And maybe a bit of embarrassment about it, but rather than have that moment of weakness in his eyes to tell Pharaoh on a nice occasion when he's given him his cup about Joseph in prison, and, you know, that would have made a nice story, wouldn't it? You know, but no, there's always the risk that Pharaoh might go the wrong way and I could end up back in there and like the baker this time round. So he doesn't. He buries it, actively gets it out of his mind. I am not going to weaken my circumstances by mentioning that to us too. Now, I expect most of us in this room have heard these stories for many, sorry, stories, I don't like that word, I do apologise for using it, this narrative many times over many, many years. I do hope that there are some lessons that have come out tonight of the way we can conduct ourselves. Yes, it's been good to study it again. Yes, it's been good to remind ourselves of the way God works through men and was preparing to put Joseph down in Egypt so that his people could be saved from a famine. You know, it's God's hand working throughout. That's a wonderful thing to see. But some of the lessons that are there for us as well. Let us always give God the glory. Joseph wasn't slow in doing that. Give God the glory. Whatever it happens to be. You know, whatever. You know, there are occasions when I've just done something really good, you know. I've done a good little job there. I know I do things wrong, but. And we start praising ourselves. Shouldn't we be, God, thank you for the opportunity to do whatever it is that we felt was good. Done some work for him. So let us always be keen to give God the glory for anything good that we do. And fully, although this isn't here, fully accept with squared shoulders when there's sin going around. That's my responsibility. No slipping that one off. You know, that should be on my shoulders. Although that isn't in this particular passage here. And I think the other one is, other than the little bits that we saw going through, this dedication of Joseph to always give God the glory and to just work for God and to preach, to tell other people. Clearly he did that all the time. But I think we can learn a lesson from the butler as well. He didn't remember, did he? When things were going good for him, he forgot his God, or Joseph's God in a way. He forgot Joseph's request. Do we forget our brother and sister's request? Could you help me with? Oh, and 6 days later, I forgot that. But we didn't really. It was a bit inconvenient, and I didn't want to do it. Well, say you don't want to do it then, you know. And but much worse than that, do we forget God, or have a tendency to forget God when things are going well for us? Is there a chance that happens in our lives ever? You know, when our backs are up against the walls, we're fairly keen to get down on our knees and pray. I don't mean necessarily physically on our knees, but quite possibly. But what about when things are just going really nice? Is that a time when we forget our heavenly Creator? I don't know, but it certainly shouldn't be. Thank you.